This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 18, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Aura Bogado. Senate leaders in the White House agree on a new immigration deal that critics fear could split up families. Paul Wolfowitz resigns from the World Bank, while the Senate increases its calls for the resignation of another of President Bush's key allies. And factional fighting in Gaza. We'll take a look at what's behind it. But first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A bomb at one of India's largest mosques killed at least 11 people today and wounded dozens more. The blast came as thousands of worshippers were in the historic mosque for Friday prayers in southern India's Hyderabad. The city has a large Muslim population and is one of India's technology hubs. The bombing at the Mecca Masjid Mosque triggered intense local protests. Police sent in to quell the demonstrations, fired live ammunition, and killed at least two protesters. No group has claimed responsibility for the mosque bombing, but some Indian authorities blame other Muslims for the blast. New French President Nicolas Sarkozy today named a new cabinet after picking a prime minister yesterday. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Sarkozy and his new prime minister François Fillon have named all the cabinet members of their new conservative administration. The justice minister is Rachida Dati, who was born in France to North African parents, a signal that immigrants, or their daughters at least, can make it in Sarkozyan France if they work hard and accept what the politicians refer to as Republican values. She's one of seven women out of 15 ministers and four secretaries of state. During the election campaign, Sarkozy promised to observe gender parity, and this government gets closer than any previous one has. Sarkozy has already acted on his controversial proposal for a Ministry of Immigration and National Identity, while adding the words integration and co-development to the title. His longtime friend and enforcer, Brice Hortefeux, takes charge there. The biggest political coup has been recruitment of socialist Bernard Kouchner as Foreign Affairs Minister. Kouchner, a founder of Doctors Without Borders NGO and former health minister, was an early advocate of so-called humanitarian intervention and supported the Iraq War. He was expelled from the Socialist Party as soon as his appointment became public. This is an interim government ahead of next month's general election. Sarkozy aims to follow that with a special session of Parliament to introduce changes to pension rights and education, as well as limits on the right to strike. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross, in Paris.
A Christian Aid report out today warns how the effects of climate change are set to exacerbate a global migration crisis and calls on the wealthiest countries of the world to take responsibility. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Christian Aid was set up 50 years ago to respond to the refugee crisis after the Second World War. But the world now faces its largest ever movement of people forced to flee their homes. According to today's report, at least 1 billion people will be displaced between now and 2050. They estimate 250 million of them will be caused by climate change-related phenomena such as droughts, floods, famines, and hurricanes. These climate migrants will add to the 155 million refugees currently displaced by conflict, disaster, and large-scale development projects. The majority are from the world's poorest countries, and many of them are internally displaced, with no legal protection and no official voice. The report warns this new migration will fuel existing conflicts and generate new ones in the scrabble for scarce resources, a world of many more Darfurs. Christian Aid has called on all nations to establish a global CO2 budget agreement, where the heaviest polluters contribute to a $100 billion fund to help poorer countries adapt to rising sea levels, increasing drought, and extreme weather. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Authorities in Nigeria have announced an amnesty for elderly inmates under a program ostensibly aimed at improving conditions in the country's prisons. Samuel Lakoya reports from Lagos.
According to Information Minister Frank Nweke, all prisoners aged 70 years and above are to be released from prison before May 29, when President Olusegun Obasanjo is to step down from office. Another amnesty goes to all prisoners on death row who are 60 years or more and who have spent at least 10 years in prison. Their death sentences have been commuted to life imprisonment. More than 200 convicts will benefit from this amnesty. The government says these measures have been taken as part of its prison reform program. President Obasanjo wants the reform process to start before he steps down so that the new government can start from where he stopped. Nigerian prisons are overcrowded and prisoners live under very harsh conditions. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The New York Civil Liberties Union has published nearly 600 pages of previously secret NYPD documents detailing a massive surveillance operation carried out against groups that organized protest during the 2003 Republican National Convention. The activities of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride, and Indie Media were monitored and included in regular surveillance reports. The documents are marked as secret, but were released this week after a federal judge ruled that not all of the files should be kept away from public view. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The White House and Senate leaders, Democrats and Republicans alike, have agreed to what could be the most sweeping immigration policy changes in the last two decades. The plan, announced yesterday, could grant legal status to millions of undocumented immigrants. But Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid expressed doubts that the Senate, which begins debate on the measure next week, could pass it. And critics are raising the alarm about a change they say could split up families by basing entry to the United States on job skills and education rather than on family ties. FSRN's Karen Miller has more from Washington, D.C.
Learn English, pay a $5,000 fine, and stay out of trouble with the justice system. These are just some of the ways that could bring a pathway of citizenship for more than 12 million undocumented workers, according to the new immigration legislation. Some said the legislation would provide amnesty for those who have already broken the law, while others contend that the citizenship requirements would still be out of reach for many. Frank Sherry is director of the National Immigration Forum. He says that the fact that these issues are being talked about is an important first step.
The deal, even with its problems, represents an enormous improvement over the status quo. We're hopeful that as the debate goes public, the enormous public appetite and hunger for a solution to this vexing and controversial and complex challenge will put wind in our sails and allow us to really fix our immigration system once and for all. And the purpose of this effort is not simply to pass a bill so that we can have a signing ceremony. It's to pass a bill that will work on the ground.
The legislation would also expand border security and crack down on employers who hire undocumented workers. Senator Edward Kennedy, Democrat from Massachusetts, is one of the authors of the bill and says America has been waiting a long time for these changes and must act quickly.
We must strike where the iron is hot. I've been around here long enough to know that opportunities like this don't come very often. The American people are demanding a solution. The president is committed. Senators from both parties are now determined to solve this crisis. Politics is the art of the possible, and the agreement we just reached is the best possible chance we will have in years to secure our borders, bring millions of people out of the shadows and into the sunshine of America.
According to critics, however, there are some aspects of the new legislation that are troubling. One major change would be encouraging immigration not based on family ties, but on education and the use of the English language. Cecilia Munoz is from the National Council of La Raza, a Latino civil rights and advocacy group.
There is one major change proposed in this legislation, which is very radical, which hasn't been considered by the House or the Senate, and that is completely changing the way our legal immigration system functions and moving it from favoring people who have ties to the United States, either because they have a job or a close family member petitions for them, and opening it up to anybody in the world who might want to petition for a visa, and favoring those with high levels of education and English language ability.
Another issue is a problem of temporary workers. In the new legislation, 400,000 temporary workers a year would be allowed to come for 3 2-year stays in the U.S., interrupted by year-long returns to their home country. Critics say this would give workers no rights and they would be open to abuse. Tom Snyder is from Unite Here, a union of textile employees.
Frankly, we're very disappointed. No labor union is going to accept temporary means temporary. That is, by definition, a second-class worker with no rights, and we intend to work very hard to change that on the floor of the Senate.
The bill also states that heads of immigrant households would have to return to their home country for a brief period before coming back to the U.S. to secure legal status. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Thousands of immigrants and their allies took to the streets of the Wilshire District of Los Angeles last night. As the Senate and White House announced agreement on an immigration proposal, Los Angeles demonstrators called for just immigration reform. They also denounced the attack by Los Angeles police officers on peaceful immigrant rights demonstrators at MacArthur Park on the 1st of May. Yesterday's march, organized by about a dozen local community and religious groups, filled more than 10 city blocks and ended at MacArthur Park. Religious leaders, politicians, community organizers, and youth delivered speeches before and after the procession. When she was only 9 years old, Jocelyn, now 12, walked from Guatemala to the United States. On May Day, she witnessed police assaulting the crowd with clubs and rubber bullets in MacArthur Park, but she said it was important for her to come back to the park with her family to demand fair immigration reform.
Lo que está pasando acá es de que estamos todas las personas que son emigrantes.
What's going on here is that all the people, that's all the immigrants and some people that are from here, are converging so that we can come and go into this country.
There were no arrests or skirmishes at yesterday's march, although police did confiscate several flagpoles, citing a city ordinance against them. The investigation into the so-called May Day melee continues. Meanwhile, LAPD Chief William Bratton announced that Deputy Chief Kaylor Lee Carter, who the department had already removed from his post and assigned to home duty, decided to retire. Several community leaders are calling for Chief Bratton's resignation. Last night's march was celebratory in tone. There was also work to be done. Dozens of volunteers seized the opportunity to ask demonstrators to sign letters to lawmakers in Washington, urging passage of fair and just immigration reform. Guadalupe Trejo gathered hundreds of letters in just a few hours.
No hay que creer que ya está hecho todo. Hay que seguirle y seguir.
We shouldn't believe that everything is already decided. We need to push and push until they listen. All of these letters will be sent to Washington either tonight or early tomorrow morning. And this is a situation in which we need to keep struggling for all the parents that are away from their children.
At least 2,000 people took part in last night's demonstration. Paul Wolfowitz resigns from the World Bank amid scandal over his role in getting a raise and promotion for his girlfriend. Pressure increases on Alberto Gonzalez to resign after testimony at a Senate hearing places the AG at his predecessor's sickbed, pressuring him to renew the warrantless surveillance program. And the nation's 11th biggest city votes to impeach President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Ingrid Drake has this week's FSRN political roundup.
In the face of pressure from World Bank employees and international bodies like the European Commission, and even the White House, which appointed him, Paul Wolfowitz resigned as president of the World Bank effective June 30th.
I made a mistake for which I am sorry. For people who disagree with the things they associate with me in my previous job, I'm not in my previous job.
Not for his leadership role in designing the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Wolfowitz's credibility took a greater hit when information surfaced last month he tried to give a promotion to an employee with whom he had a romantic relationship.
As we would drive by, little kids would run up to the road in order to wave and give us a thumbs up sign. Over and over again, thank you, President Bush, thank you, Prime Minister Blair, thank you, coalition troops, for liberating us.
Under a tradition that the U.S. gets to name the World Bank's president, Japan and many European nations are calling on the Bush administration to use a merit-based and transparent process to name a replacement, which some have speculated may be Tony Blair or former U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick. Yet regardless of who is in charge, the institution remains corrupt, says Basav Sen with the Mobilization for Global Justice.
Even a different process for hiring the president would not change a few fundamental facts. Number one, the voting structure of the institution is weighted very heavily towards wealthy countries, and thus the institution can be used and has in fact been used as a political tool by the United States and the other so-called G8 wealthy countries.
The end may be near for another Bush administration leader, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and his role in targeting 26 U.S. attorneys for politically motivated firings. Next week, Democratic Senators Charles Schumer of New York and Dianne Feinstein of California may put forward a symbolic no-confidence resolution for a vote on the Senate floor. Gonzalez in April at the Senate.
Senator, I don't recall that. Senator, I can't recall. I do not recall.
Norm Coleman from Minnesota was the sixth Senate Republican to come out against the Attorney General in the wake of the testimony of former Deputy Attorney General James Comey. According to Comey, Gonzalez visited the intensive care unit to urge then-Attorney General John Ashcroft, who was recovering from surgery, to switch his position on the secret warrantless wiretapping program.
I thought I had just witnessed an effort to take advantage of a very sick man.
President Bush has declined to comment on whether he ordered Gonzalez and then-Chief of Staff Andrew Card to make the hospital visit. Going all the way to the top, the Detroit City Council passed a resolution on Wednesday calling for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Citing harm caused by illegal domestic surveillance, misleading the U.S. into war with Iraq, and utilizing torture in violation of international law, Detroit became the largest of more than 60 cities to push for impeachment. An advocate for the resolution and member of the Detroit chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, William Goodman.
It reflects the fact that this issue is still very much alive and a very vibrant issue within the American political discourse. And the reason for it is because the continuing revelations of the, really the crimes of the Bush administration just grow more and more profound every day.
While the Democratic presidential candidates have been trying to differentiate themselves from the policies of the unpopular Bush administration, they are not free from critical analysis in the independent press. Writing Hillary, the corporate candidate, for The Nation magazine, Ari Berman links Senator Clinton's key campaign staff to Texaco and Eli Lilly, as well as corporate public relations firms. For the Free Speech Radio News Political Roundup, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Two Israeli airstrikes have killed at least four Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today. This brings to at least 10 the number of Palestinians killed by Israel over the past 2 days. The Israeli assault comes amid ongoing fighting between the armed wings of the rival Palestinian Hamas and Fatah factions. Over the past 6 days, that fighting has killed more than 45 people. In Jerusalem, FSRN's Iris Mackler takes a look at what's behind the violence.
In Gaza, the pattern of the past 6 days is repeating itself today as well. There's been fighting between Palestinian militias inside Gaza, Palestinian rocket fire from Gaza to the south of Israel, and for the second day since Israel has been drawn into the conflict, Israeli airstrikes as well. Israel says it's attacking targets from the Islamic group Hamas, which has claimed responsibility for the barrage of rockets fired into Israel over the past 72 hours. But Israel's actions have been criticized, even by one of its friends in the region, King Abdullah of Jordan, as well as by Palestinian Information Minister Mustafa Barghouti.
Of course, we are responsible for our mistakes as Palestinians, and these factions, Hamas and Fatah, are responsible for the bloodshed that took place. But let's be frank and say that Israel and many other external forces have been feeding the possibility of internal fighting. This place has become a place of chaos where every external force is trying to use the Palestinians for their regional and international interest, and this must stop.
Over the past 6 days, Palestinian civilians have been trapped in their homes while gunmen from Fatah and Hamas fought on the streets around them. The gunmen were heavily armed with missiles, mortars and RPGs, and also positioned snipers on the tops of buildings in Gaza City. But what's emerging after 6 days is that this is not a descent into chaos, but an organised military campaign. Analysts say that Hamas is responsible. Avi Sakharov is an Israeli analyst and journalist specialising in Arab affairs.
It's actually organised. It's something that was planned by specific operation. They went by a list of Fatah officials to kill them one by one. It was pretty much amazing to see how they're doing it.
The Hamas operation was initially directed from Damascus, where the head of its military wing, Khaled Mashal, lives in exile. But now local militias are also taking control. Analysts argue that Hamas began this action when it became apparent that joining the National Unity Government in February had not brought results, specifically the lifting of the international embargo on aid. Money has been coming in, but it's gone straight to the leader of Fatah, President Mahmoud Abbas. Hamas decided that it had to strike sooner rather than later, or its enemy would become too strong. And analysts argue that Hamas is winning this confrontation.
Hamas is winning big time.
Avi Issacharoff again.
I talked to some Fatah officials and they agree, they recognize that they are losing because of unorganized operations, because of lack of motivations, because of lack of leadership.
Palestinian rockets continue to land in Sderot, the Israeli town nearest to the border with Gaza. Israel's cabinet will meet Sunday to decide whether to escalate the military response. There are fears that the Gaza whirlwind could consume the entire area. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
In Thailand, a rare interview from London with exiled Premier Thaksin Shinawatra triggered a crackdown yesterday on community radio. A small station, Confidant, aired the highly unusual interview. Claudia Craig has more.
The former Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra had not spoken to any Thai media since he was ousted in a military coup last September. Station announcer Chu Pong Te Tuan is said to have been shocked and speechless when he realized who was on the other end of the phone. Listeners in Bangkok told FSRN that he stated, "Today's darkness won't last long. When democracy returns to Thailand, all lights will brighten up your life." He also called for an early election. Within a short time, broadcast regulators filed a complaint to the police, accusing the station of broadcasting without a license and airing content that undermined national security. The airwaves at 87.75 FM on the broadcast dial in northern Bangkok then went silent. The head of the National Broadcasting Commission, Bhavorn Tetcha-In, denies that orders were given to shut operations down, saying instead that the station was not legally authorized for broadcast. Dr. Ubunrat Siriyuvasak is an Associate Professor and Deputy Dean of Research and International Affairs in the Faculty of Communication Arts at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. She was a UNESCO Chair in Freedom of Expression, a joint project between UNESCO and the university.
Previously, of course, the Thaksin government also tightly controlled the media and shut down a couple of the community radio, being one of the very key issue and foundation for freedom of speech for the people in general.
According to Tony Ellison, speaking from the Asia Times Online Bureau in Bangkok, where he is deputy editor, there wasn't much positive reaction locally for Thaksin, who during his tenure also engaged in well-publicized infringements of free speech.
It's very hypocritical of Thaksin because this is exactly what he was doing. I think they just see it as part of the ongoing campaign by the present government to tackle any legacy of Thaksin, whatever it might be, and anything that he does, they're just going to clamp down on.
Nevertheless, the government has now detained three alleged Thaksin supporters said to be preparing for an anti-junta rally in the former premier's home province, Chiang Mai. These are the first detentions of their kind against dissidents since the coup in September 2006. With the closure now of community radio stations as well as lack of access to broader media, Thais are wondering where else Thaksin will pop up. For the moment, a number of his appeals from exile continue to be found in various online social networking sites. For FSRN, this is Claudia Craig.
Broadcasters that stream music on the World Wide Web may soon have to pay a lot more money for the songs they play. A recent decision by the Copyright Royalty Board would significantly increase the fees web radio broadcasters owe to record companies and artists. Web radio outlets say the fee hike will force them to close up shop. Even terrestrial radio stations with web streams may soon be faced with some difficult decisions if they want to stay online. FSRN's Eric Klein has more.
The increased fees for streaming songs over the internet are set to take effect on July 15th. One of the many businesses that will be affected is Pandora, an online radio service that lets listeners create stations, or personalized music streams, for free. The site makes money by selling ad space on its webpage. Tim Westergren is the founder of Pandora. He says that the new royalty rates will make his business and others like it unsustainable.
It's a tripling of the rates we've been paying, so it's millions of dollars. And for small webcasters, there are many whose bills would have been $40,000 and are now $500,000.
Westergen says that the Copyright Royalty Board's decision to dramatically increase rates sent a shockwave through the internet radio community, which quickly banded together into a coalition called SaveNet Radio.
Pandora emailed all of its listeners and asked them to speak out and contact their congressperson. Hundreds of thousands, literally, I think over 400,000 people, reached out to their various representatives.
Democratic Representative Jay Inslee of Washington State introduced the Internet Radio Equality Act in Congress last month. If passed, the bill will keep royalty rates down temporarily and require the Copyright Royalty Board to revisit the issue using a different set of criteria.
My bill would have a much more fair, common-sense position so that Internet companies that do business over the Internet don't pay any more than companies that purvey this information over cable or satellite. And that's really a fair thing to do. This has been a tremendous technology. People are using it. We're getting great, diverse music, diverse viewpoints.
But there are groups that don't want the rate increase to be delayed. Sound Exchange is a nonprofit company created in 2000 that collects millions of dollars in royalties from music played on the internet, satellite radio, and cable television. It then distributes the money to the artists and labels that own the songs. John Simpson is Sound Exchange's executive director.
One of the reasons why we're very concerned about getting fair value and making sure that we're being paid fair value for music online is that there's this incredibly rich offering. You can find thousands and thousands of different kinds of stations all playing, you know, very niche repertoire. It's a wonderful service. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, people say to me, oh, well, you know, people are hearing lots and lots of new artists and they're going out and buying lots of different kinds of records. And unfortunately, that's not what the evidence is showing.
Simpson says that if passed, the Internet Radio Equality Act would more or less undo 5 years' worth of negotiations and official hearings between webcasters, the recording industry, and other parties that led up to the latest rate increase. But some stations still say the rules changes are coming from out of the blue. Michael Manicheri is the web director for Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California, the first listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio station in the world.
Now we have to take the time to count up exactly who's listening, how long they're listening. I mean, some non-commercial stations are facing this as they're going to maybe hire someone to do this because it's a lot of work. And this came up so suddenly, people are scrambling to figure out what to do to comply with the law.
WFMU is a listener-sponsored music station in the New York area that was one of the first terrestrial radio signals to begin simulcasting over the internet. Ken Friedman is the station manager.
I have a lot of friends who worked in the record industry in New York who are out of jobs, people who had very successful careers for decades and are now suddenly unemployed. So I see what the record industry is dealing with in terms of, you know, their loss of revenue. But their attempt to monetize everything that they can possibly monetize and to try to extract so much money out of the webcasting industry is the completely wrong approach to take.
Friedman says that if and when the new rules take effect, WFMU may have no choice but to limit the number of listeners online. Capping online listeners runs counter to every radio station's mission, but some are considering it in order to afford the new fees for streaming music online come July 15th. There's an appeal in federal court for an emergency stay of the rate increase. Meanwhile, in Congress, the Internet Radio Equality Act has about 70 co-sponsors. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFA in Berkeley. I'm Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Aura Bogado.